Hello, and welcome to the Robert A. Heinlein Book Club. And let's do this. Let's talk about Starship Troopers. So this will be the first of, I think, of about two episodes where I'm going to try to explore this novel and its legacy and its consequences and what we can do with it. Now, obviously, this is high on the list of controversial books like in the whole history of science fiction. If people say Heinlein is a fascist, this is their evidence. There might be other evidence out there. There probably is if you wanted to dig around, but this is the novel that people go to for that. If there's one Heinlein novel that people read, it tends to be Starship Troopers. It's the one that your average person on the street knows. Maybe it's because of the movie, but this is, arguably his most important book. It is the one that has defined his legacy more than maybe any of his others. Now, I think that's rather unfortunate. I think there are other books that look at other sides of Heinlein, that expose other parts of his character and personality and his ideas and his philosophy. But this one has to be dealt with, and these are themes that in a read through like this they're going to have to be wrestled with. So I'm going to do my best to give you my overall thoughts on it. Now the novel itself is there's not that much in terms of story to actually talk about. It's basically a young man, Johnny Rico, joins the military, fights in a war, moves up through the ranks, becomes an officer, and we see hope at the end that the war is going to be won. I think the last scene is preparing for another attack on the bug homeworld, with the implication that they've pushed them back to that point and are ready to kind of finally win this war. It's kind of like the wars against Carthage, right? They're actually called out in the text at one point, the wars against Carthage, the Punic Wars, right? And which was only ended when Rome totally destroyed that civilization and destroyed its city. That's where we're at, kind of at the end of the novel. And we have that main story, and then we have four flashbacks. I've counted them. I know a lot's been made of these, the history and moral philosophy class he takes. There's actually five scenes like this, but only four are told in flashback. So there's this course he takes both in high school as a required class that all students take, and then once he takes it as part of his officer training school. I guess the advanced version of this class is called History and Moral Philosophy. The fact that it shows up twice suggests to me it's not just a high school class of politics, like the equivalent of a civics class. It's actually history and moral philosophy are joined disciplines at this point, right? There's no, like, I guess history is mentioned as something like that you study, but the fact that in officer school he also takes a class called history and moral philosophy suggests to me that is, history is joined with this moral philosophy, right? There's four flashback sections that deal with it. And we're going to go through those one at a time. And then there's one told, the most extended example of this is the one he gets in officer training school. And that deals with slightly different issues. Each kind of takes on a different question. And I think that's maybe one way to go about this, rather than trying to look at that as they come up, to set them out, take them apart, and look at them one at a time. Because I think this is the heart of it. And I guess I'll kind of give you my thoughts reading this book this time about this, is the arguments are not good. The arguments are presented as scientific. In fact, we're often repeated, like, especially in the one he does in officer training school, that, like, bring the evidence, bring the data, prove it scientifically, prove it mathematically, these are points. This is never done. In fact, Heinlein sort of makes an excuse for himself, saying, like, oh, go prove this mathematically and bring it to class tomorrow. We never actually see the proofs, because these are things that can't be proved mathematically. certainly under any logic that we would be familiar with. Is it possible maybe the student did do this? Yeah, but Heinlein doesn't have to show us that work. He asked the students to do this through his characters, but we're never at, he never does it himself. So there's that. By and large, the arguments are not good. So what do we make of this? Is this really Heinlein's belief? I think it's hard to deny that at least partially this is what he thinks. And it doesn't make him look good. Part of his legacy, I think, has been tarnished by these sections. I think if they were out of this book, people would be less uncomfortable with this text. Now, obviously, this is a popular book and a famous book, and, it's the version I have, which is the Ace version. Ace publishes a bunch of Heinlein's books, the controversial classic of military adventure. So that's a nice way of putting it, I suppose. Controversial, yes. You can sell it as controversial, and then you don't have to really. You kind of sell it as a classic, right? As a piece of literature. But you go to a bookstore, look up Heinlein. That's probably what you're going to see, right? That's still on the shelf. Maybe Stranger in a Strange Land, and this. I think Ace also publishes I'll Fear No Evil and Time Enough for Love too. So, but you're not going to see it at the Barnes and Noble. This you probably would. What's my point about this? I've kind of lost my train of thought partially. My point is that this is still a popular book that people read, and they read those sections, those history and moral philosophy sections, and they get those arguments, and depending on the reader, they're going to take them, or they're going to do three things with them. One is they're going to say, wow, Heinlein, you're awesome. I agree with you. Only veterans should vote. And the only value is that got gained through suffering and struggle. We'll get to his talk on value soon enough. The other thing we can do is say, oh, Heinlein's like trolling us with these ideas because I've read All You Zombies and he's actually super woke and based and super progressive. And he's trolling us here with this. Others are going to, I guess, try to say this was Heinlein's ideas and be critical of them or try to contextualize them in some way and say Heinlein did seem to think these things and Heinlein's just a weirdo. And that's why we're doing a whole podcast series reading Heinlein's work is because he is so weird and interesting and difficult to wrestle with. And his ideas are very complex. And that's kind of where I am with this. I do think Heinlein is preaching to us in a bit. I just don't think the preaching is very convincing, especially if you separate them from the book and like present them in a philosophy class or something, which is what he's doing, right? So I'm only doing what he's telling us to do. And if you look at these arguments, and they're just simply not that good. They're not kind of convincing. And he strawmans a lot of things when he does them. So let's, before getting into the point, the plot of the novel itself, let's go through these sections on the history and moral philosophy sections. The first is in chapter 2, and it is about violence. This is actually the scene, the movie scene that does this. There's one scene in the movie that condenses, I think, about two of these conversations into one. But really, this is the heart of it, is does violence solve problems, right? Historically, I actually agree with this. It's not it's kind of a low-hanging fruit, though, to say violence solves a lot of political conflicts and tensions throughout history. So here's the quote. He's actually arguing with a student, a female student, and in the movie version, he has this conversation with Carmencita. She says, "You seem to be unaware of it. The fact that Carthage was destroyed. Since you do know it, wouldn't you say that violence has settled their destinies rather thoroughly? However, I wasn't making fun of you personally. I was heaping scorn on an unexcusably silly idea, a practice that I shall always follow. Anyone who clings to the historical untruth and thoroughly immoral doctrine that violence never settles anything, I'd advise to conjure up the ghosts of Napoleon Bonaparte and the Duke of Wellington and let them debate it. The ghost of Hitler could referee, and the jury might well be the dodo, the great auk, and the passenger pigeon. Violence, naked force, has settled more issues in history than any other factor." Okay. True, yes. Is the idea that it doesn't immoral? You could almost argue, yes, it is, because to deny the fact that violence is force in history would lead one to kind of maybe, I mean, that's kind of, it's hard to say this clearly, I think. Maybe I should have written this out. A pacifist ignoring the violence of history, like a hippy-dippy liberal type ignoring the violence of history, that would lead to immoral, like, conclusions about history, right? Because force does dictate people's lives in often very horrible ways. The problem, you know, this is kind of presented, even though the term immoral is in here, it's presented kind of morally neutral. Yes, violence has solved problems. Does it always solve it for the better? That is not really taken up here, in a way. I guess where there might be a problem is in his final sentence of the passage. I actually cut it out on purpose. He says, breeds that forget this basic truth have always paid for it with their lives and their freedoms. Does this mean violence is the only way of settling destinies? I think that's it. He doesn't quite say that. It's the question is, does violence never settle anything? And it, clearly it does. So, I don't know. This first one, this first little glimpse into the history of moral philosophy class is fine, I guess, as a historical truism. Should violence be the only way we solve problems? If Heinlein is saying that, then I have a quarrel with him. But for now, we can just leave it. The second window into the history and moral philosophy class that Rico takes in high school is all, chapter 6. Now, this is a 14-chapter book, but the last chapter is kind of a novella, or the penultimate chapter is a bit of a novella. So we're kind of halfway through the book almost when we get the second window into this class. And this one is on value. So it's here's where we the quarrel I have with Heinlein is a little clearer. Now he partially brings my wrath on him, you know, by his own fault, because he criticizes the Marxian definition of value. He's attacking the labor theory of value here, right? And he comes to instead a labor theory of value. That's my issue with this. So anyone actually reading this would kind of, now to his defense, he does say, like, maybe Marx was close to a more proper theory of value. I think what really Heinlein's trying to say here is there's a suffering or a struggle theory of value. But he contradicts that because he tears down the Marxian theory of value by saying basically there's only use value, which Marx, of course, invents the language of use value and exchange value. He's quite aware of this. I think Heinlein hasn't read much Marx, so is he supposed to? No, he's a science fiction writer. But if he's bringing up the Marxian theory of value, he should understand it a little bit better. But he says, okay, Marx's theory of value is wrong. Instead, really, value is relative. He says, literally, the student says value is absolute. I think Rico says this. And he says, wrong. Value has no meaning other than in relation to living beings. The value of a thing is always relative to a particular person, is completely personal and different in quantity for each living person. Market value is a fiction, merely a rough guess at the average of personal values. Okay, that is not contradictory, really, what Marx says about exchange value. Or, in a sense, use value. Use value can be different for different people. But his attack on the labor theory of value is just asinine, because he says, well, people can make mud pies all day and it would have no value. Yeah, like, Marx knows that. That's why he talks about socially useful labor time. Obviously, not all labor is valuable, and it's in the aggregate that labor creates value, right? It's across the economy. It's a working day times 3 billion. 4 billion, whatever, how many workers we have on the planet. So, blah. But then, okay, but fine. He's making a criticism. He's doing what the anarcho, so-called anarcho-capitalists do and say, like, attacks the labor theory of value, which you need to do if you want to attack Marxism. You need to deal with it because labor theory of value leads you to the tendency of the rate of profit to decline and capitalist crises and all of Marx's other conclusions. If you can't challenge this, you're in trouble in any criticism of Marx, right? Okay, but where does Heinlein end up here? He finally then goes, Nothing of value is free. Even the breath of life is purchased at birth only through gasping, effort, and pain. If you boys and girls have to sweat for your toys the way a newborn baby has to struggle to live, you'd be happier and much richer. Like, dude, he comes to a labor theory of value at the end. He says, like, but it's kind of just defined as struggle. Now, what is Heinlein trying to do here? Why is he attacking value? Or why is Dubois, the teacher here, attacking value? Partially it's to say, yeah, anything of value must be earned. The tree of liberty must be watered in the blood of patriots and tyrants. A quote of Jefferson he makes, in the I think it's in the same chapter where he ridicules the idea of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, also written by Jefferson. He never really grapples with the fact that the same person said these two things. And I we'll get to that, I guess, too. But he's trying to say, I think, that humans don't have value. That is, don't have objective value. Or at least that's the philosophy of the society. Only through struggle, right? So this is getting into the citizenship argument. Like, only veterans really have a right to vote, should have the right to vote or whatever, or to make decisions. And that's better than democracy and better than authoritarianism. All right, let's deal with this. So I'm not very impressed with this section. I think he essentially is offering up a labor theory of value almost, but it's defined kind of more narrowly than Marx. I think Marx was well aware that labor does involve struggle, right? Effort, sacrifice, right? What are we doing when we're working in a factory if not sacrificing 8, 10, 12 hours of our day to produce something of value for society? Right. Okay. Next, chapter 8. Chapter 8 is the one with the Dillinger execution. If you've read the book, you know that. And here we get the flashback to, it's the third flashback to the Dubois High School History and Moral Philosophy class. This is the longest of them, I think. This is about crime, punishment, and morality. Now, I just recently read Exiles to Glory. I pronounced hated it because it really racialized this idea that society is kind of breaking down. I don't know why people in the 50s and 60s and 70s are so obsessed with this. Maybe I can understand the 60s, the Nixon quiet majority idea that there's kind of societies falling around us and we need to kind of stand up for law and order. I kind of get Purnell's content, historical context, a little bit than Heinlein's, because I don't get the sense the 50s was a period of people like, there's like a lot of gang warfare or something going on. You had greasers, I guess, but it's kind of a caricature, right, of gangs. Actually, organized crime was a lot stronger in the 50s. Maybe there's something to it. But my image of the 50s is much more like the Philip Dickian idea of like boring suburbia, people in suits going to work every day. But anyways, this is the longest of the sections of the speeches we get by Dubois. And basically, he's saying, it's wrong to punish juvenile delinquents because the real criminal is the society that didn't raise them properly. So people are compared here to dogs, saying dogs, you have to house train them, you have to beat them, punish them for when they... Now, I don't know the best way to house train a dog. I like cats. I'm a cat guy. Do you actually have to... Like, what's the current hypothesis on the best way to house train dogs? Is it through, like... punishment. I mean, obviously, conditioning of some sort is involved in house training dogs, but my understanding of like Skinner-esque, operant conditioning is that reward tends to do a better job than punishment. But that's the argument here, is that children who misbehave because they have not been properly trained, properly raised. So his ultimate conclusion here, why does he go through this conversation? Well, it's obviously in Rico's time. This is a flashback to him after seeing the execution of a child murderer. And he says, the problem is capital punishment, corporal punishment, I should say, was forbidden in school. So, flogging was not seen as lawful. You didn't have the strict punishment, so you had misbehaving. But that's not the fault of the children necessarily. It's the fault of society that didn't train them properly. And the conclusion he comes to is that people have no moral instinct. So we have people don't have value intrinsically except through struggle. which is kind of existentialist in a way, if you want to go that far, to say you have to kind of create your own value. You're not given it at birth. That's what existentialists obviously agree. And I kind of do agree that, you know, any value we give to each other is that. It's given to us by each other, right? I think by nature we don't have, like, my quarrel with Jefferson is we're endowed by our creator with certain inalienable rights. We can certainly endow each other with inalienable rights. That's, in fact, what we do. That's what the Declaration of Independence is doing, essentially. Okay. People don't have a moral instinct is the point here. It has to be trained. We acquire a moral sense, we're told, when we do through training, experience, and hard sweat of the mind. These unfortunate juvenile criminals were born with none, even as you and I, and they have no chance to acquire any. They had no chance to acquire any. Their experience did not permit it. What is moral sense? It's an elaboration of the instinct to survive. The instinct to survive is human nature itself, and every aspect of personality derives from it, end quote. Now, my argument with this, and then, of course, this leads then to morality and duties relationship. But we don't have natural rights. He does criticize life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness here as natural rights that we get from space or from the universe. But I actually agree with that part of it. But the whole argument here about human beings not having any inherent moral sense isn't just, I think, evolution, anthropology attacks this, right? We have a tendency towards cooperation. We don't have to go to modern anthropology. We just have to go to Kropotkin, right? His evolution book, Mutual Aid, which is a biological text, and Kropotkin was a biologist. We can look at species that are cooperative. We know humans have a cooperative instinct, right? It's, you know, we didn't drag ourselves out of the cave through individual competition and struggle the way the fascists want to say that. We worked our way through this with through cooperation largely, right? Okay. So that is that. So I'm kind of like neutral on one, or I think the first one is on violence is kind of just a historical truth that, depending on how you interpret it and the conclusions you draw, I would agree or disagree with you. The second and third, dealing with value and punishment, I seem to disagree with, both for psychological and anthropological reasons. And then chapter 11, we get our fourth window into this class of history and moral philosophy, which is about citizenship, and it's quite short. If I can find it, it's very, very short. But nevertheless, I knew at last what Colonel Du Bois had been talking about. The mobile infantry was mine and I was theirs. If that was what the mobile infantry did to break the monotony, and that's what I did. Patriotism was a bit esoteric for me, too large to see, but mobile infantry was my gang. I belonged and were all the family I had left. There is a passage here where we get the back and forth in the class about citizenship, but there's not much here. It's just briefly discussing defining citizenship as being connected to service, which obviously everyone knows that about this book. It's even in the movie. Okay. The last one we get is, I think it's chapter 12 or so, is another different teacher. So a different point of view. And it's about citizen, and it's delivered in Rico's officer training program. And here we get the larger argument about citizenship being tied to service. And basically, we have different models presented here, and they're all struck down pretty arbitrarily. We're told there's science behind it, and it can be proved mathematically. We never get those proofs, as I suggested before. Why don't we? Well, I think because Heinlein's foolish crap here, to be honest. Okay, we have, on the one hand, we have democracy. Give everyone the right to vote, broadly. And I will say, in Heinlein's defense, this society is a fairly open one. People have rights. Citizens have one extra right, and they can vote. They have the franchise. Beyond that, it seems to be a fairly free society. There's no gender discrimination. although units seem to be segregated here. I like that the movie made the units desegregated and showering together, of course, is always great. Sexually liberated, we don't get much of that, but Carmen Sita, Rico's a little bit like, he kind of wants her, but he's not like slut-shaming Carmen Sita for seeming to have many sexual partners in high school. It's just taken for granted that that's what women do. There's no racial discrimination. Rico obviously is from Filipino background. The heroes of the historical infantry going back in time, which we see in the names of the ships and things, and in the culture of the units, is interracial. I think we know by this point Heinlein isn't racist. The only little racist thing here, it's a little thing, and you kind of have to squint to see it, although obviously we can make a big deal of it if we want, is that the Chinese are compared to the bugs, or the bugs are compared to the Chinese in their use of kind of mass infantry assault tactics, that they don't care, the implications, they don't care about the lives of their soldiers. This is before or the Korean War just started. China entered the Korean War in 19... Oh, no, this I'm sorry, I'm a decade off. Yeah, so he's looking at the Korean War, maybe, and seeing the mass infantry assaults during the Korean War by the Chinese. I don't say that China didn't care about their soldiers. It's just how they won that war. From their point of view, they won it. I guess it was kind of a draw, but they did stop the U.S. from achieving its goals, I suppose. In that sense, the Chinese won through mass infantry assaults. Just like the Soviet Union used that to a degree, although that's been questioned by some historians to the degree that the Soviets were just kind of using their manpower to win the war. But, that's a way to win certain wars, and the bugs were using it, and the Chinese used it. Now, we got a mythical war here where the Chinese kind of did this. Mao Zedong himself said something like, if there was a nuclear war and we lost half our people and, we'd still have, 400 million people, more people than the United States. So, we could win a nuclear war just by resources. Mao was stupid in this way. But, he was what? What did the Chinese say? He's 70% right, 30% wrong. This is definitely something he was wrong about. But Heinlein's not getting this from nowhere, even though it might be a little racist. But overall, this book does show racial equality across humanity, gender equality. Rico's he comes from wealth, but he's not privileged in any way because of this. There's still class, but class seems to be fairly muted here. And maybe the veteran thing, the franchise plays a role in that, right? We don't have enough about like tax structure, how all this is funded. I wish we knew more about society. Actually, that's another criticism I have of this book. I want more about this society, more than even we get, and less like preachy. And I want to know more about the bugs and the skinnies too, the two alien species we get. Okay, anyways, let's talk about this class. Again, this is not Du Bois. This is someone else he's getting this from. And this is all about citizenship, and we get a little bit of the history, how the veterans imposed order and created this system of only veterans vote, right? And again, like, the society seems fairly free outside of this. It's actually very different. The movie presents more of a propagandized fascist dictatorship, in a sense, than the book does. And that's kind of going to be my conclusion here. This last point, well, he throws out democracy. The officer who's teaching them says, democracy is no good. It's not going to work because people don't value their citizenship. But authoritarianism, one man only voting, is kind of thrown out too as not useful. The Plato's Republic is defined here as sort of a hive mindness, which I don't get. I think maybe he didn't read it that carefully. And that's rejected. The bug communalism is rejected for humans anyways, although it seems to work well for the bugs. They lose the war, or they seem to be losing the war, but they, it seems to work pretty effectively for them. Basically, we're just told that this way of just having people who served whether they were in the infantry or not, it's like if they serve, that's an important point, right? There seems to be many ways for people to serve, and it's a right to serve. You have to, they have to take you, even if you're blind and deaf and can't walk, they have to find some way for you to serve for your 2 years. It's just kind of stated it's the best way. Now, interestingly, one of the students asked the question, like, why not just make everyone serve? And indeed, why not? I don't think that's dealt with very well here. Somehow it's like about the choice, I think, Heinlein wants to say. It's the willing, if you're forced to do it, it doesn't have the same meaning. It's not the same sacrifice. And he actually says, that's just conscription, and conscription sucks. We don't agree with it. Because it's force. It wouldn't mean the same thing if it was by force, but by like a conscription-based citizenship. But I'm reminded of Frederick Jameson's book, The American Utopia, which I think hasn't got enough conversation. I've seen a few YouTube videos about it and his talks about it, but there hasn't been much conversation about it. But Jameson's argument is that if we're going to have an institution that from which communism can emerge in America, it can only really be the military, because that's the only kind of unimpeachable institution in American life. And so this communism should come through the military, just draft everyone, reform the economy to be adjuncts of the military, extensions of the military. So you'd have your army coders making Elden Ring. You would have your army Hollywood making the movies, and everything would be just socialized this way. But of course, the military would also do its fighting. And that's we got a bit of that here too, where this idea that a lot of people who do service are going to just have to go into the ether. They won't go into the infantry. They'll go into this nebulous, ill-defined service. And there's implied like garbage collecting could be service. Some R&D might be. We don't get enough of this. I wish there was more explanation of this side of it too. But through this, everyone can have a chance to serve. But Jameson's idea is just do this, just make everyone in the army, and then everyone would have health care, everyone would have a job, everyone would have an income and a housing, just like you do if you join the military, right? You get those things. So that idea is just thrown away as a conscription model, but I don't think that's the way to look at it. I think we need to go to Bellamy and Jameson and see a better model for this. Obviously, he couldn't have read Jameson. But he could have read Bellamy, and Bellamy had the idea of a universal industrial army. It wasn't an uncommon idea in the 19th century. So anyways, that is the history and moral philosophy discussions, and they're just not good arguments. We're told it's scientific, and this could be proven scientifically, and he never does it. Heinlein doesn't bother doing it. So I think in a way, even though I've talked more about this than most of my episodes in this series, in terms of length, we're at, 30 minutes already. In a sense, I want to say we're making a mountain out of a molehill with these passages, because, again, it's just five passages amounting to probably 20 pages, less than 10% of the book. But my conclusion is, yeah, Heinlein is kind of preaching to us. He's just not being very convincing. And maybe some young readers disgruntled with society, maybe with a libertarian taint, may see something in this they like, but I can't imagine it being convincing to too many people now with what we know about psychology, what we know about child rearing and what punishment and violence does to children. I don't even think it pans out in how you discipline a dog to get them housebroken. I think rewards seem to work much better for this, is my understanding. I think the only point of agreement I have with him might be on, violence does seem to resolve things in history, but is that a moral necessity? Are we supposed to draw moral conclusions from that? I think not. I think it's not necessarily the only way to solve problems. In a sense, we're agreeing with Mao Zedong, all political power comes through a barrel of a gun. Yeah, that's true. That's what the state does. It's not very profound. So we kind of got these arguments. Okay, now let's stop here and say, all right, what about the fascism claim? Well, I'm going to start with my definition of fascism. First, fascism must be anti-communist, right? That, if we're going to understand, that's prime in my definition. It's anti-communist. It's also anti-liberal. So it's against the Enlightenment in general. So anti-communism and anti-Enlightenment, these go together in the sense that Marxism and communism is a natural extension of the Enlightenment. Militarism must be a part of it. Elitism. Elitism across society. Elitism being a positive good, not a necessary evil. I think where you have some liberal elitists, they will, if you pin them in a corner, they'll come to the conclusion that elitism is a necessary evil to run an institution or a society. You need to vote for a president and give them power. You know, we're, you know, you need to have some people, an educated elite maybe. It's a necessary evil, but not ideal in a democracy. Fascists would say, no, elitism is a positive good. I think fascists would also emphasize nature, and not here like environmentalism, although there are some ecology studies I've read about ecology and fascism and how they were kind of interested in nature in ways that maybe the communists in the Soviet Union weren't. But anyways, there is a focus on nature, but it's a really kind of a social Darwinian view of nature, that nature is just struggle and violence. And struggle between human societies is an extension of nature, right? So it's a misreading of the evolutionary record and our biology. But it's what they believed, right? So a lot extends from that. Their racism, their elitism extends from this idea that nature is just a struggle. And then you have this kind of the weird aspects of fascism, the quasi-spiritual, weird religious stuff, the nebulous philosophy of nature and will, which I think also extends from their view of nature. A lot of fascism is this view of nature as conflict and struggle. So going through these points, you have some of this, obviously. The idea of humanity being without value and just being a like struggle and value coming through struggle, that is an element in fascism, I think. Militarism, oh, boy howdy. If this book is not a celebration of the military, I don't know what is. You'd have to be pretty blinkered to try to equivocate on this. I mean, and I'm someone who's like said, we can read Lovecraft against the grain on some of these racial issues and find interesting results. Go back to my series on that. This, I don't know, maybe someone can try. I think we really have to, you have to be Holderman and write The Forever War, explicitly anti-army, anti-war text to get around this. Is Heinlein a militarist? Yeah, I think he is. He's praising the military and service, and especially the infantry. And I think maybe what we could say is he's like, there's a whole passage where he's like, the Navy thinks they can do this without us, but you need to get in the dirt, in the mud. And he's trying to say, like, maybe the infantry, he was a Navy guy himself, right? But he's trying to say the infantry, the what they say, call them in Babylon 5, the ground pounders, right? They have to. That's actually an interesting episode of Babylon 5, because you saw the infantry sort of being scorned by the Navy, right? Our characters are all kind of Navy. But that he's trying to say, he's kind of doing a bottom-up military science fiction, saying we're never going to not need the infantry. We're never going to not need that aspect, that role. As mechanized as they might be, they use nukes. They use chemical warfare. They use all kinds of fancy stuff and technology, but it's still, you got to put feet on the ground. I think that's a contribution anyways, but there's so much praise of it and there's no criticism of war itself that definitely this is a militarist novel. Anti-communism? I don't know. Heinlein was not a communist. So there's some level of anti-communism, but not like what we see in fascists. And there's not the racism. There's not the elitism. I actually think this is a fairly anti-elitist novel outside of the idea of the veterans being the only ones with the franchise. Pretty much everything else in this society is pretty egalitarian and neutral about gender and race and class even. Rico is not privileged. It's not like in the 18th century or the German army under the Nazis where if you were from rich families, you got officer positions, right? And that was considered kind of a good thing. There was a natural idea of a natural elite. That is rejected. You have to earn your position. And everyone can. So I think that's an interesting aspect of this. Or it's a thorn. It's a wrench in the works of the argument that Heinlein is a fascist, because you don't have the strong anti-communism here. Except the throwaway lines that Marx sucks, and you know the bugs are communist and they're the bad guys. But you know, you could set this in a more communist society. The only thing in the way of even this being a communist society, I suppose, is the fact that Rico's from a rich family and there seems to be like independent businesses. Sanctuary is presented as kind of a market economy, although heavily, heavily militarized. It's really, the sanctuary is the secret base that the humans have, which is, we're told like half the industry is just military contracting, which in the Jamesian sense I mentioned before kind of would be how you get to communism. So I think except for the fact that Rico's from a rich family and they own businesses, this could be a communist society. Why not? With this kind of weird veteran thing where only veterans can vote. But since it's open up to everyone, why not? I mean, It's not like, in fact, many communist values are on display here, like equality. I think this is it's got egalitarian aspects that make it not an easy fit as a fascist novel. So do you have some fascist elements? Yeah, but to call this a fascist book or to say from this book, we can therefore say Heinlein's a fascist? No. There are weirdness throughout his whole career. And there's goofiness. But I think this is a lot better than some of the astounding stuff where you have literally a genetic elite, people with superhuman powers. Like Beyond This Horizon, you have that. And the goofy racism of Sixth Column, you don't have. This is, and I think the praising of the infantry in the military is sort of a bottom-up thing. So it's a complicated question, is what I want to say. But yeah, Heinlein deserves a little bit more analysis than reading one book and reading 20 pages of one book and saying, because of this, Heinlein is a fascist. All right. What should we do now? Talk about the book? I guess so. Let's try to jump into it. I kind of front-loaded this with the stuff I wanted to say. And I'm not going to end. I'm going to finish up this episode, talk about the plot and the story. And then in the next episode, I want to talk about the legacy of it, I suppose. But that'll probably be shorter. But let's get into the book. And I want to look at these epigraphs. If you listen to the audiobook, you don't get the epigraphs because the audiobook doesn't get the rights to all of these, I guess. Some of these are public domain quotes, but you need the separate rights for that, right? Because usually audiobooks don't include all the epigraphs. Stephen King ones do, but I think Blackstone or whoever would have actually sought the rights for those. I guess that's how it works. I don't think the audiobooks inherit the rights that were the permissions that the author got. But correct me if I'm wrong about that. All right, chapter one, the quote is, "Come on, you apes, you want to live forever." Which is, it's nice that this is the last line of the movie, right? Rico saying it. It's the ending of the movie, going back to the very first line of the book. I appreciate it. Unknown platoon sergeant in 1918. I think the Marines, right, said that. But anyways, this is an operation during the war after Rico's training. Now, in the timeline of the war, we know there's two phases, right? Well, there's three phases. There's the open the behind this, like the skirmishes that are going on, prelude to war. Then we have the period where the skinnies and the bugs are on the same side. Then we have the period, and that's when Buenos Aires is destroyed. You have the failed attack on the bug capital homeworld. Then at some point after this operation, you have the skinnies flipping sides. And then from the skinnies, humans are able to get enough intelligence to learn how to fight back. So they develop gas weapons, chemical weapons that can kill the bugs but not kill humans. And they learn about the brain bugs. And then in the climax of the book, we have the capture of the brain bug by Zim, also replicated in the movie version. And then the final scene is this predicted final conflict, right? This first chapter is in that second part of the war where you have the skinny still on the side of the bugs, but the humans are, the mobile infantry are attacking this skinny town. And this is what convinces them to flip sides. Now, obviously, this goes back to the theme, violence solves the political problem. Here, the political problem is this alliance. It's solved through violence. How this is done, I don't know. I want to know more about the skinnies, to be honest. You're thrown into it. If you read this chapter carefully, you might learn a little bit about the skinnies, but definitely there's space to learn more about them. But the skinnies are... now, another lesson in this chapter, here's what I want to say, is the mobile infantry, and we're told this many times, is they're as violent or nonviolent. They're a tool, and they can do mass violence if they need to. They can do restrained violence if they need to. They just follow orders. If the orders are not to kill civilians, they won't kill civilians. If the orders are to massacre millions of bugs, what's the range? Like at one point in the book, they say, if one mobile infantry guy dies for 1,000 bugs killed, or is it 1,000,000 bugs killed? That's a victory for the bugs. I mean, the bugs are like dying by the thousands. But however, the bugs are, you know, in the movie, you got this idea of there's creepy crawly things that can kill you with their bodies. Here they have guns. So I don't know if they're just walking cockroaches in Heinlein's mind, I guess. But they're not in this first scene. It's against the skinnies. And there's restrained violence is being used. That's the lesson, that they're able to restrain the violence, target it only where it's needed to accomplish the political goal. That's the lesson of the first one. And it's a nice opening battle scene to get us started in the book and get us introduced to Rico and the fact that this is going to be a military science fiction. All right. Chapter 2, the quote is, "It scared me so I hooked it off, nor stopped as I remember, nor looked around till I got home. Locked up in my mother's chamber, Yankee Doodle keep it up, Yankee Doodle dandy, mind the music and the step, and with all the girls be handy." So this is a patriotic song from the original Yankee Doodle, I guess. And this chapter is about the decision to join. We are introduced to our first moral philosophy lecture from Du Bois, the teacher. He says, "I never really intended to join." That's how the chapter begins. And we got this brief scene with, which I remember this being longer when I read it before, but it's actually only a couple pages, where Rico's father's like, no, you're not going to the mobile infantry. You're not going to go do service. Instead, I'm going to pay for your trip to Mars. You always wanted to do that. You'll see space that way. You don't have to join up to see space. And then you'll go to business school at Harvard. And that's it. Now, this family apparently has not served. We're told in the text that some parts of the planet, you have very high service rates, and some parts low. And it seems Rico's family is just one of those families that just decides never to serve. But this is kind of dispensed with. And then he's at school, and his friends Carl and Carmencita, his one-time girlfriend, do go. Now, in the movie, of course, Carmencita is presented as a more of a love interest than she is here. I love how she's presented in the book, though, because the movie makes this kind of love triangle, and you kind of have suggestions here of a much more sexually liberated society than even what we get in the book, because in the movie, yeah, they shower together, but they're still kind of stuffy about relationships. Now, of course, Rico's parents are married. But at least as far as Rico's generation, they seem not to care. When he's on Sanctuary, he seems to be hooking up with the local girls. Carmen, Sita, seems to have many partners, even in high school. And it's never like my woman kind of relationship. He's a little disgruntled about it, but not like bothered by it, I guess. Anyways, he decides mostly to go because of Carl, it seems, but maybe Carmen has a role because when it's revealed that she wants to go into the Navy, into become a pilot, just like in the movie, it's the same kind of relationship. In the movie, it's more Carmen is the reason he goes, but here, I think his friend Carl has a bigger role. And then we see him go to do the sign-in and the opening tests, and we learn about the service and how they take everyone, but how they actually discourage people from joining because there's not enough jobs for them. Now, it's a right. They have to take everyone who wants to sign up. It's a right of citizenship, but, well, not citizenship, right of being a civilian, a resident, a human, I guess, it's right of humans, but to at least have the chance to become a citizen. But they don't want everyone. So they even have this guy with no legs. It's a fake no legs guy to scare people away from joining. He is finally assigned the mobile infantry because his grades aren't good enough for anything else, and they couldn't really fit him anywhere else. He thinks he wants the canine units. I want to know more about the canine units too, where people seem to have this deep connection to the dogs. Fascinating, but anyways, he gets the orders for the mobile infantry. Then chapter 3, the quote is, "He shall rule with a rod of iron," from Revelations. And what do we get? Well, we get the first of several chapters about training. About half of this book involves just the prelude that we just covered and the training. I think up through chapter 8, it's not until chapter 8 that we get our training, although we have like the flashbacks and with that chapter 1, which is set after his training. But chapter 3 is his arrival at Camp Arthur Curry, which is in Antarctica, or is it the North Pole? Yeah, I think it's the North Pole. But Arthur Curry, of course, is a World War I general. There's a couple minor military figures, infantry guys, are called out. For instance, his ship is the Roger Young, which is, there's a whole historical note at the back of the book about the Medal of Honor winner from Ohio who did some heroism. He's kind of a World War II sort of Alvin York kind of character. Alvin York's also called out at some point in this book. But anyways, we have the opening cliched scene of the drill sergeant torturing the young recruits. But whatever. You've seen that before many of times, and it's replicated in the movie too. Chapter 4 is really emphasizing how few make it, and the weaning out. And again, this is something that's encouraged by the service. Unlike now, they probably wouldn't be too happy if you went AWOL here. They kind of look the other way. It's taken for granted. I think we have a 10% graduation rate, we're told at the end of the training process. And mostly these are people who are just like, yeah, not for me. The quote is from Judges. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but the people are yet too many. Bring them down upon the water, and I'll try them for thee. So he brought down the people under the water, and the Lord said unto Gideon, everyone that lappeth up the water with his tongue, as a dog lappeth, he shall thou set by himself. Likewise, everyone that boweth down to on his knees to drink, and the number of the men that drank, putting their hands to the mouth, were 300 men. And the Lord said unto Gideon, by the 300 I'll save you. Let all the other people go. So it's few make it, right? That's it. But also we got this image of like the dirt and grime and difficulty of the training. So anyways, chapter 4 mostly focuses on that, on the marching, the counter-marching, the 50 miles out, staying overnight without gear, 50 miles back, the kind of stuff you go through in training. Although it doesn't seem pleasant, and people weren't happy with it, but we're told again and again that like, yeah, it sucked, but out of it comes my later, it's community building, it's camaraderie building, and it's important. Chapter 4 then is more about discipline. The quote is an ancient shanty. None of this is This is all public domain so far, but he's bound to be guilty. Wouldn't be here. Starboard gun fire. Shooting's too good for him. Kick the louse out. Port gun fire. So this is the risk of service, I guess, this chapter's about. Heavily on discipline. We also learn about weapons trainings. But the heart of this chapter is the Hendricks court-martial. So Hendricks is a guy who wants to join for a politician, to become a politician. And so he knows his rights, or he talks about his rights. And we get a little bit of a prelude to this idea of you don't really have rights, or, you know, or rights are just something we decide to give you. But he's got a purpose for joining mobile infantry, politics. Now, interestingly, the character that this is based on in the movie version is a black woman who wants to go into politics, and she accidentally shoots someone, and she's kicked out. And Rico is punished because he was in command, and he made a mistake that led to the guy's death. Here, it's a little bit not so serious. Hendricks is told to freeze, and he moves after this because of ants. He falls on an ant, and then he gets punished. He gets hit by Zim, and Hendricks turns around and hits Zim. But Zim wants to cover this up, so he's just trying to give him administrative punishment, which is like 3 lashes in the field, and that's it. But Hendricks insists on a trial, and so they take it to the officer in charge, and he's going to be, instead of a full court-martial, he's going to be punished with 60 days. But he lets loose something Zim didn't let loose, that he's hit Zim. And this forces the commander to court-martial him. First I think they whip him and then court-martial him, right? Yeah. And drill him out. He's out of the mobile infantry. Really interesting chapter, actually. It's at this point you're like, this book maybe has some, it's just interesting military science fiction. Because the stuff up to this point is just normal stuff we've seen in any any story about training. Maybe at the time it was not so done that often, but we've heard this story so many times. Okay, anyways, chapter 6, we get a Thomas Paine quote. What we obtain too cheaply, we esteem too lightly. It would not be strange indeed if so celestial an article as freedom should not be highly rated. And this is the moral philosophy section on value, which I talked about before. Heinlein misuses a couple founders here. Tom Paine, he's misusing here. I think he's misusing Thomas Jefferson. But this chapter mostly is about the value of freedom and sacrifice needs to be for freedom. The discussion, it begins with Rico overhearing a conversation between the commander and Zim, and over Zim's failures, because why did we lose this man to a court-martial? Well, it's because Zim did not treat them like as the threats they are, you know, like the way teachers often get a close relationship with their students over time. That's what happened to Zim, and Zim is kind of scolded, and Zim says he wants out and just sent to the normal infantry. Interestingly, that's where Zim ends up. In the climax of the book, is all about Zim's heroism at the end of the day. Although we don't learn it until the end of the chapter, that it's Zim's central to that, the climax of the book. It's also about the over the hump period for him, where in fact he gets this letter from Dubois, who was retired mobile infantry before he became a teacher at this little high school, and he says. He's like, you're over the hump. You're going to make it. That's why I'm writing you at this point. Okay, chapter 7, the quote is from Kipling. The young recruit is silly. He thinks of suicide, a lost is gutter devil, and ain't got his pride, but day by day they kicks him, which helps him one bit, till he finds himself one morning with full of a proper kit. Now, that poem's fine. It's really, this chapter is about the suits. And their weapons training and things like that. Mostly it's introducing the suits. I kind of wish the movie had that. I guess it would have raised the budget a lot, is to have the power suits, the power armor. But it's, we learn about that. Now Rico also gets administrative punishment here for even though it's simulated ammunition, he shoots in a place that's not cleared, insured to be cleared. That's big mistake because people could have died if it was a real battle. So he gets 5 lashes, which is the most anyone gets in administrative punishment. That makes it through. Hendrix got more, right? All right, that's chapter 7. I think I'm going to stop here. I know I said I was going to finish it, but it's kind of running at the end of my time I have here. So instead of stopping this and picking up and finishing the episode later, I'm going to talk about chapters 8 through 14 at the start of the next episode and then do what I said before, talk about the legacy of it. But here we're at. So anyways, let me know what you think about Starship Troopers, at least the first half of it, as well as like the philosophical issues we try talking about. Part of me still thinks we take Heinlein a little too seriously here. I do think he's preaching to us, but his arguments are so bad, they hardly are like a threat to liberal society and the genre and science fiction, right? That we may make too much of this. Heinlein was a weirdo. We all know that. And that's why he's kind of endearing to me. He's not like Purnell, who I recently read, who's just like a vicious reactionary. You know, he might actually be a kind of a fascist. Heinlein is just too weird and goofy to be easily reduced to one thing. And the book's fine. The book's got its value. It's not his best book. It's just something we sometimes take too seriously. And here I am doing an hour-long episode on just part of this book. So I guess I'm doing the same thing. But I feel this book has to be talked about. So anyways, next time we'll finish up my coverage of Starship Troopers. Thanks for listening. Let me know what you think. I'll see you next time.